Support for the New Hampshire News Recap comes from you, our listeners, and from the University of New Hampshire. UNH research helps generate significant economic benefits for New Hampshire, including job creation and economic development. Learn more at unh.edu/research.
It's Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Galley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. The director of the New Hampshire Division for Children, Youth, and Families is disputing many recent allegations at the state's Youth Detention Center. Marie Noonan testified before lawmakers this week. Concord Monitor reporter Jeremy Margolis is here to tell us more about that. Morning, Jeremy.
Good morning, Rick.
Good to have you back here. Jeremy, many of the concerns of abuse or improper restraint have been detailed in reports. What are the specific concerns about the facility that Noonan is disputing right now?
Yeah, so Director Noonan disputed or seemed to downplay nearly all of the fresh allegations that have emerged in recent weeks about the facility. For example, advocates have said that children are being restrained in the prone position, which is against state law and is known to be dangerous. Noonan appeared to suggest that children were actually placing themselves in that position, but when I asked about that, she declined to elaborate. She also said that children had not been under lockdown in the facility for about 6 weeks, as had previously been reported, and she disputed a claim that children had been deprived access to water.
How did the child advocate, Cassandra Sanchez, respond to these new comments?
So Sanchez and her office are still in the process of conducting an investigation. Because that investigation remains ongoing, she didn't comment directly on Director Noonan's claims, but she did say that she had reviewed videos that showed children being placed in the prone position by staff rather than placing themselves in that position.
I knew Noonan sent a letter to the Disability Rights Center late last week arguing that the center's investigation and visits to the facility are actually having a negative impact on the kids and staff there. Can you tell us more about what Noonan is saying in that letter?
Yeah, that was the most notable aspect of the letter to me. She wrote that the visits had emboldened the children there to push back against discipline at the facility. For example, she described one child who accused staff of violating their rights, and she wrote that the claims that the Disability Rights Center had made were agitating what she described as impressionable youth that were being held there.
So she's asserting that, you know, they're getting attention from this and using that.
Exactly.
Okay. What's next for this? As lawmakers are continuing to investigate these allegations of abuse and neglect at the center, I know the governor has said in the past that she wants to get to the bottom of this. What are you watching for?
So there's several parallel investigations that are playing out right now. The one that we've been discussing, which this subcommittee of the legislature is conducting. They had said previously that they were expecting to put together a report by today, actually, but at that hearing or session earlier this week, they said they're actually going to need more time, perhaps up to a month longer.
So what do you think happens next in this, Jeremy?
Well, I'm going to be very curious what this subcommittee says. They were clearly concerned. Some of them seem skeptical of what Director Noonan was saying. There's also these three other investigations, one by the Child Advocate, one by the Disability Rights Center, and a fourth by the Attorney General's office. And they're all happening at the same time. And it's going to be interesting to see where they all come out.
And we'll be watching for more of your reporting of that. New Hampshire colleges are celebrating a potential bump in student enrollment. Jeremy, I know that's something you reported on this week. It was a bit of a surprise for schools. Why were schools anticipating fewer students this fall?
We're in the first year of the demographic cliff. That's this long-anticipated decline in enrollment due to birth rates. And there had been an expectation, perhaps, that that would lead to lower first-year enrollment at schools across the state.
So what are schools attributing that this freshman increase to enrollment? What are they attributing that to?
So I spoke to administrators at the University of New Hampshire and New England College, both of which had larger first-year enrollments than they did last year, and they cited different factors. UNH school leaders attributed the increase to a new messaging strategy that focused on the value of a UNH degree. And at New England College, the vice president of enrollment management attributed the growth to new programs, particularly in athletics. The college started a football team in 2024, and that seems to be paying dividends. Almost 50 students, roughly one in seven members of the incoming class, our recruited athletes on the football team.
Yeah, so some of it's changing programs and some of it's marketing, I guess. But even with potentially strong freshman enrollment this year, overall class sizes are expected to go down. Isn't that true?
At UNH, that's true. And that's because the graduating class, the class that's graduating this weekend, actually is larger than the class that is going to be enrolling next fall, even though that first-year class is bigger than the university had expected.
Yeah, so I guess celebrate the victory right now for this year.
Yeah.
Something else, I know that you've been covering open enrollment legislation on life support after some House Republicans voted it down in late April, but school districts are working out their own policies about students who can enter and leave their districts through open enrollment. Jeremy, can you remind us what open enrollment is?
So open enrollment is this policy that allows students to enroll at a school in a district other than the one that they live in at no cost to their family. It's been proceeding in these on these parallel tracks this year. So there's the local policies, which were prompted by a Supreme Court ruling last fall. Residents in nearly 100 school districts opted to enact their own open enrollment policies. And then at the state level, legislation, which now appears stalled, would mandate open enrollment everywhere, which would take that policy making out of the hands of local school boards and residents.
Okay, so where are we right now in terms of these policies? What are schools required to do? What's still at their discretion? What's going on there?
So in the districts that enacted their own local policies, the voters set the number of students who can enter the district and leave the district through open enrollment. But the school boards now must decide a variety of things. For example, when to set application deadlines, what to do if more students enroll than they have capacity to accept, and to what extent to recruit students to apply rather than just sort of just passively let them do so.
Okay, so it's a little scattershot here. It's all different depending on what school system you might be in. But how will these open enrollment policies impact next year's classes?
Yeah, so I was really interested to see if there's going to be a massive migration of students and reached out to a variety of administrators. And it seems like it's probably not going to have a massive effect next year. And that's because of a quirk in these local policies, which allows districts to prohibit students from leaving under open enrollment. Because so many school districts took advantage of that, even if students want to enroll, they're not going to be able to do so.
So what else are you watching for as we get into, you know, ending this year and getting to next year and watching the legislation? What are you watching for?
Well, that's the big question. Is there going to be a universal open enrollment policy that's passed? I think the House, which needs to flip a number of members of its party, is facing an uphill battle here based on conversations I had with some of those defectors in the House. The legislature is still meeting, so we're gonna have a much better sense in the next month whether there's going to be a universal policy that gets passed.
Jeremy Margolis is a reporter for the Concord Monitor. You can read more from him at concordmonitor.com. Jeremy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
New Hampshire is full of historic homes, barns, and churches that are at risk of falling apart, but there's a shortage of people who know how to repair them. And HBR's Jackie Harris joins us now to tell us more about an effort to preserve the state's landmarks by building up the workforce that can repair them. Hey, Jackie.
Good morning.
Good to have you on the recap. Jackie is our Morning Edition producer, but Jackie's doing some independent reporting on this. Tell us more about what the issue is here. Why can't any old contractor just work on a historic building?
Part of the issue is keeping the historic character of the building or structure in place, these historic places that, as New Hampshire residents, we love to see. So, for instance, an old barn from the 1700s or 1800s might have been constructed with timber framing, which is an old building method where timber beams are joined and fixed together with wooden pegs, not nails, because nails weren't as available back then. If a contractor had to repair that old barn, maybe a side of it caved in or something, and they didn't know about timber framing, they might be stumped by the barn's construction and therefore how to repair it. They could decide not to take the job, or they could repair it with, say, nails or some other method that takes that historic touch away.
Gotcha. So why aren't there as many people doing this work anymore?
essentially, young people aren't joining these historic trades as fast as tradespeople are retiring. Some people I talk to say that's because schools aren't giving as many shop classes for students anymore. And there has been, of course, a push for students to go into higher education rather than vocational schools. But also, these historic techniques like timber framing or stone wall repair aren't really taught in vocational schools either. So this has all led to this real shortage of people who know how to do this work. I talked with a stonemason who has a years-long wait list, multiple years, and another timber framing contractor said he's able to pick and choose jobs that he wants to do versus ones he doesn't want to do because he's in such demand. And I spoke with this organization called the New Hampshire Preservation Alliance. They connect people who know historic trades with clients looking for their services. They said if the wait for repair work is too long, people could decide that restoring an old building just isn't worth it. Here's Jennifer Goodman with the Preservation Alliance.
And what that can mean is, you know, loss of old windows, loss of old plaster, loss of an old porch that's really gives the building its character. You know, on another level, we can see that there could be demolitions and total loss of buildings if there aren't enough people around to do this work.
Okay, Jackie, so what are people trying to do to address the shortage?
I got to go to this program the Preservation Alliance created to address this issue specifically. On school vacation weeks, they bring high school students to a historic landmark, like the Canterbury Shaker Village in this case, and they pair them with experts who've had successful careers in blacksmithing, timber framing, or stone foundation repair. And there they do the hands-on repairs. The goal is to expose the students to other types of vocational careers, but it's also open to students who aren't already studying construction. So I spoke with Rowan McGrath at a roof repair workshop at the Shaker Village. He's 18 and studying computer engineering right now, but he thinks the historic trades workshops will give him options for his future career.
You know, so much people want to go into the tech industry. It's, you know, AI. You know, it's a big thing that's going to probably take over tech. So I have something I can rely on as a backup, and it makes pretty good money.
And Jackie, your story was all about history, and that's a topic on many people's minds right now with the nation's 250th anniversary just weeks away. So tell us a bit more about the reporting that NHPR's newsroom has planned to kind of mark the milestone.
We've got a lot of stories underway looking at how people are celebrating or mulling 250 years of the U.S., and we're thinking about how our country's early history still resonates in New Hampshire today, how that history is being taught right now, what patriotism looks like right now. We've got a story from Mara Hoplamazian coming up next week about a local flag maker. It's a busy time to be in that line of work, Rick.
Absolutely. And you know what? Go to NHPR.org. Check out Jackie's story that she went to look at this Preservation Alliance and look at these kids that are really learning about these trades. It's fantastic.
Thank you very
much.
Great
pictures.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, and be watching for Mara's story next week and so many more stories we have planned here at NHPR to celebrate the 250th. NHPR's Jackie Harris, thank you, as always.
You're very welcome.
I'm Rick Gamley, and this is NHPR.